So, thanks very much for having me here. So the organizers asked me to talk about thermal dark matter, and so that's supposed to be mostly for the experimentalists. But I think a lot of the theorists will know the things I'll talk about, but it's maybe not bad to review some of the things anyway. So the first question is, so here's some of the questions I want to answer through these lectures I've got for the two lectures I have. So the first question is, why care? Right, the organizers are very wise. There's a school on tabletop experiments. Why do you want to talk about thermal dark matter? Why is it relevant? So we'll try to answer this. Then I want to discuss the WIMP miracle and freeze out, and if it's really a miracle. And I want to show you that sort of the mass range for thermal dark matter is going to be between the viable mass range is going to be between MeV masses and 100 TeV. And I'll tell you where sort of the where in the context of tabletop experiments this comes in. So for tabletop experiments, we'll care mostly about the lower mass range, where there's lots of new ideas for tabletop experiments or below the GeV scale, and I'll talk about why what's special about this range as well. Okay. So let's start. So to begin with, I want to first make sure that everyone's on the same page. So we use natural units, right? So H bar and C and KB, they're all one. And so for example, 1 Kelvin is about 10 to minus 4 eV. And we'll everything's I mean units of energy. And we'll yeah, so this lower mass range, that's where the electron, of course, is, and the protons that are GeV, and then the heaviest Standard Model fermion is going to be 172 GeV for the top. But that's sort of the relevant mass range for thermal dark matter as well, where the Standard Model particles lie. Okay. So we use lots of back of the envelope estimates. I'm not going to include most of the time factors of pi and so on. I just want to give you the basic ideas. And one thing that I don't want to derive, but I'll just state, is that there are several standard thermodynamic relations which one can derive, and that'll tell us what the quantity, what certain quantities are in equilibrium, in thermal equilibrium. So an important one is the number density. So N, the energy density, rho, and we'll also sometimes mention the entropy, which is entropy density. So this is going to be S. Okay, and one important relationship is that. For so all these things, by the way, what I'll write down, I'll just won't derive these expressions, the different what exactly this looks like, I won't derive it, but I'll just use it. So these can all be derived from Fermi-Dirac or Bose-Einstein distributions, depending on what, if it's a fermion or boson, and or from Maxwell-Boltzmann equation, which Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution if it's non-relativistic. And one important quantity is that N goes as T cubed for relativistic particles. And N goes as MT to the 3 over 2 times e to the minus M over T for non-relativistic. Okay, so these just come from sort of standard distributions, which I don't want to derive, but they're important for us too. We're going to need to use them. Okay. Now, one important quantity in the universe is the critical energy density. So the critical energy density is going to be given by, so rho crit, which is going to be given by very few times I can use an equal sign. Here I can. So this is going to be 3/8 pi g over h naught squared, where h naught is the Hubble constant today. And very roughly, the numbers that you put, that you get, is about 5 to the 10 to minus 6 GeV per cubic centimeter. And even more useful, maybe, is this is about 5 proton masses in a cubic meter. Okay, so on average, the density is 5 proton masses in a cubic meter. So obviously, we live in a place that has a few more protons per cubic meter than the average critical density. Okay, than the critical density. So what we can do with this is we can actually ask, how many dark matter particles are there? So we don't know, of course, what the mass of the dark matter is, but we know what the energy density is of the dark matter today. And we can write down the number density of dark matter particles depending on the dark matter mass. Okay, so let's do that. So we know from data that that omega dark matter is defined to be rho dark matter over rho crit. And that's going to be about 0.26 from data. And then what we can do is we can just estimate what the number density is of dark matter today. So often I use a subscript 0 for quantities that are measured today. So number density of dark matter today, that's going to be dark matter density today over mass of the dark matter. And if I put in the numbers, that's going to be about 1.3 times 10 to the minus 3 per cubic centimeter times 1 MeV over the dark matter mass. Okay. So about 10 to the minus 3 per cubic centimeter for an MeV dark matter particle. Now, locally in our Milky Way halo, the dark matter number density is much, much higher. So it's about 400. Okay, so just as an aside, so N dark matter local in the Milky Way galaxy, this is about 400 per cubic centimeter for an MeV particle. Okay, again, just making the point that that we live in a special place, so to speak. Okay, with a lot of structure around us. Now, initially, the universe was hot, right? So we know that at least around temperatures of an MeV, about 1 second after the Big Bang, we understand from that point onwards, we understand the universe reasonably well, and that it needed to be hotter at least at some point than that, maybe quite a bit hotter. But so after, presumably some inflationary period, the universe then reheated to some temperature higher than BBN. And the basic question we can ask about dark matter is, was the dark matter thermal equilibrium with the standard model matter at this high temperature initially? Okay. So, yeah, basic question, was dark matter in thermal equilibrium? And if the answer is no, then its abundance needs to be set by, maybe some initial conditions, or maybe it still had some very weak contact with the standard model. So it wasn't in thermal equilibrium, but there was still some interaction going on between the standard model and dark matter. But it needs to be set by something like this. And you heard some examples from Giovanni earlier this week, right, about the misalignment angle. I think you talked about that. Misalignment mechanism. So we say here, dark matter abundance set by, for example, initial conditions. Or maybe very weak contact, where you still had some kind of mechanism for the standard model particles to leak into the dark matter. A weak contact between the dark sector, so the dark matter, and the standard model. And examples of this are the QCD axion. We'll talk about. I'll mention actually briefly if I have time next lecture. I'll mention Friesen dark matter, stereo neutrinos could have gotten their abundance from this case here where they were never in thermal equilibrium. So it's like a Friesen Freedom Document of Canada? And for these lectures, if the answer is yes, in that case, okay, so in that case, if the answer is yes, then what we know right away is that initially the document abundance was given by T cubed. So if it isn't thermic equilibrium at high temperatures, then right away we know that chi is often going to be my dark matter particle. So then immediately it's going to be given by T cubed. And since you know the temperature of the standard model bath is said to be given by the photon temperature, so that's going to be T gamma cubed. And what we know then is that today, the number of dark matter particles today that we would have is given by 400 cubic centimeters, per cubic centimeter. Because essentially that's the number of CMB photons we have around us, okay, that are about 400 per cubic centimeter. So then there's a lot of dark matter particles. If we compare that number now to the one we had here, in terms of how much dark matter is actually around us, you see that this number is much, much smaller, unless the dark matter mass is very, very small. Okay. So if we have very small dark matter masses, about you know EV or 10 EV or so, then we would have a number abundance set by what we would get just from some thermal contact directly. But if the dark matter mass is heavier, then somehow we have to find a way to actually get rid of the dark matter. Okay, so it's not so much about actually producing it. Once you set it in thermal equilibrium, there's a lot of them. But the trick is, or the challenge, or the goal, is to actually get rid of it, to explain why there's not so much dark matter around us. But the goal, yeah, so let me just say here, this is much bigger than N dark matter. Sorry, let me call this chi here. And if I define that to be my number density of actually that's measured, then this is much bigger than NDM0 today, unless the dark matter mass is less than about 10 eV. Okay, just from that relationship over there. So the goal is you have to get rid of most of the dark matter. Okay, so not how to produce it. And another way of saying this is that the entropy density in the universe also goes as T cubed if it's a relativistic species. So this is actually also just the entropy density. And another way of saying it is that we have to get rid of the entropy, okay, in some way. You have to remove entropy from the dark matter system. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay. Now let me ask another question, right, which goes back to the point, why do we care about thermal dark matter? Let's ask the question, how easy it is actually for the dark matter to be in thermal equilibrium, right? What kind of interactions do we need? Is it easy, or is it like some weird models that we need? How easy is it? And for this, I'm going to do some very simple back of the envelope estimate again, just to sort of illustrate the point. Okay, how easy for dark matter to be in thermal equilibrium. So one way to estimate, or a good way to estimate whether something is in thermal equilibrium, is to compare the interactions that keep the dark matter in thermal equilibrium, the interaction rate of some interaction that keep it in equilibrium, with the expansion rate of the universe. Okay? So if we take sort of an approximate condition, require the interaction rate to be bigger than the Hubble rate, the expansion rate of the universe, then the thing will be in, then the dark matter particle will be in thermal equilibrium. Right, so this here is the interaction rate. It has units of one of a time, or national units would also have units of sort of a mass or an energy. This is the Hubble rate. That's the expansion rate of the universe, which of course is depends on the time of the universe that you're at, right? So this is defined to be A dot over A, where A is a scale factor, but and has units of one over time as well. So, you know, so we're comparing correct quantities in terms of the same dimensions. That's the expansion rate. And if we satisfy this condition, then the interactions have enough time to thermalize the dark matter easily, okay, and keep it in equilibrium. Now, in order to answer this, it's very useful to derive a formula for Hubble, okay, that you should, that's good to know, okay? So there's actually a very simple approximate expression you can have for the Hubble, for the expansion rate, okay? So for that, so the question is, what is H as a function of time or as a function of temperature, right? So the temperature of the universe always decreases, so it's sort of a good proxy for one over time. So what is H of T, an expression for this? What we can do is we can use Friedmann equations to show that H squared is, which is H dot over A squared, is 8 pi over 3 G rho, okay? And rho is the energy density of the universe. Since we are in the relativistic, since we're in the early universe, stuff will be relativistic, so this is essentially the relativistic energies of the relativistic particles. G is 1 over m Planck squared. Let's work with m Planck instead of G. And the energy density is going to scale as T to the 4. So it's an energy density, units of energy over volume. So you can write the natural units, it will just be T to the 4. So this is approximately just whatever is in radiation. And that is going to scale as 8 pi, no, sorry, pi squared over 30 T to the 4. Okay. During the radiation era, so it's a during radiation domination. Okay. And then from this, right, all we have to do is we plug this rho in here, and then we get, and we put G in, one of our Planck squared, and we put together all the factors, and very roughly, what we get is that Hubble rate is going to be given by T squared over M Planck. Okay, and that's a useful formula to know. Right, I'm neglecting some details which are not important for our purposes here. Okay, so that's a useful formula. Now we've got this expression for H. Now let's try to estimate, to get back to answering this question, how easy is it for dark matter to be in thermal equilibrium? Let's imagine some interaction rate where the dark matter interacts with the standard model, and like dark matter particles can annihilate, produce standard model particles. And let's write an approximate formula for that rate from dimensional analysis. And in particular, I'm going to do that at a time when the temperature is of order the dark matter mass. So all the relevant energy scales are just the dark matter mass, okay? Just to avoid any complications. So of course, in general, right, this what this gamma is depends very much exactly on what the interactions are, what the mediators are that you have, how strong they interact with the particles. So it's, in general, it's a, you know, you need to know exactly what you're talking about in terms of the particle content. But very roughly, so for gamma, consider, for example, this diagram, sort of some simple diagram, where I've got my dark matter particle interacting with standard model particles. There's some interaction, there's some coupling strength that determines this, which I'm going to call alpha x. And I'm just going to take this as a temperature where everything is of order the dark matter mass. Okay, I want to just evaluate this condition at the dark matter mass temperature. And if we do that, right, so we take our gamma, oh, yeah, so what's the gamma then in that case? So just from dimensional analysis, gamma has to scale as this alpha coupling squared, alpha x coupling squared, times the dark matter mass. Okay, that's the right dimensions. And then we can ask, how strong does this interaction have to be that I've parameterized here with alpha x in order for thermal equilibrium to hold? So what we can do is we just take this gamma and compare it to the Hubble rate, which is T squared of M Planck. And again, I'm taking temperature of the order dark matter mass. So I'm putting my T equal to M chi here, or MX. I keep changing MX and M chi. That's okay. They'll look almost the same. So what we then get is that, so this should be bigger than M chi squared over M Planck. And then I can solve for alpha x. And what I get is that alpha x should be bigger than m x over m Planck square root. And if I just put in some numbers, this is about 10 to the minus 10 mx over 100 MeV square root. And what you see here is that in order to have thermoequilibrium, just in this very simple process, alpha x can be quite small, 10 to the minus 10. And if it's bigger than that, you're in thermoequilibrium. So it's very easy for the dark matter particle in the early universe to be in thermoequilibrium. So easy to be in thermal equilibrium. Now, another important point that's, I think, worth making is that these couplings, right, they're not that small. And if you ask yourself a question as an experimentalist, what kind of dark matter models can I probe in the laboratory? Then, of course, you need to probe, you can only probe dark matter models that have some kind of appreciable enough interaction with your dark matter. So this says that, you know, a good dark matter candidate to probe in the laboratory would be things that have a large enough couplings and therefore were likely in thermoequilibrium. Okay. And these couplings, so thermal dark matter is sort of a good thing to study because those are often the dark matter candidates that can be probed, that have sizable interactions. And let me make this point here. So the couplings are not small. So I can probe dark matter in the laboratory. Right, and then also sort of another way of saying it is that if you want to probe dark matter in the laboratory, then it was likely in thermoequilibrium. Now, let me ask you a question. Okay, first of all, by the way, that statement that I just made, there are lots of exceptions, right? There's ways to, and I'll show you one actually in the second lecture, that you can probe things that are not necessarily in thermoequilibrium, of course, in the laboratory. But let me ask you a question. So Giovanni told you about non-thermal production mechanisms. So why are we able to probe a lot of non-thermal dark matter candidates with, you know, fancy sensing techniques and quantum sensing techniques and other things with cavity experiments and so on? Why are we able to do that if the couplings need to be small? If the couplings therefore are small because they're whenever in thermoequilibrium, how can we do that? What's different? Large coherence, very good. Yeah, so large coherence and also the number density of dark matter particles depends on the mass, right? And once you go below sort of the EV masses, the number abundance of the dark matter just becomes huge. So if you're probing a 10 to the minus 10 EV particle, the number abundance is just massive, right? So you have a lot of dark matter particles to deal with. You don't want them, so they can't be in thermal contact because there's bounds on that. But you don't need them to have large couplings to probe them, okay? So the things that we're talking about here that require large couplings are really for heavier dark matter masses. So if you want to probe sort of MeV and above, those kind of dark matter particles will likely have needed to be in thermoequilibrium in order for you to detect it in your experiment, because you just have less of them around, okay, just from the number density. All right. Maybe one more point to make about thermal dark matter right now is that unlike a lot of other dark matter abundances, so if it wasn't thermoequilibrium, right, we said here that maybe the dark matter abundance was set by some initial condition. But for thermal dark matter, it's independent of any specific initial conditions of the universe, right? All you're saying is that let it be in thermoequilibrium and then automatically has a T cubed abundance, all right? So it's sort of insensitive to the initial conditions.
Can you explain again where does that lower bound come from?
Which lower bound?
Oh, that n pi squared over something.
Just from solving this?
Yeah.
Which comes from this. You want me to explain this?
No. I'm just trying to think, what's the physics behind, like, dark matter interaction rate being bound from below?
So this equation here, all I'm saying is that I want the dark matter to interact enough with the standard model to have this kind of process in order for the thing to remain in thermal equilibrium and also chemical equilibrium. Okay. That's what I want. And if I want that, then I need the interaction rate, which tells me how often my particles are scattering with each other, to be larger than the expansion rate of the universe. And the rough and a good proxy for that quantity is the Hubble rate, which depends on exactly what the energy content is of the universe and what the matter content is of the universe, and the temperature that you have.
Okay, thank you.
Does it answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. All right. So now, once it's produced, right? So the trick is we have to get rid of it if it's thermally produced, because there's a lot of it, especially if we're considering heavier dark matter particles. Now, what do we do? So, of course, exactly how the dark matter abundance, how you get rid of the dark matter abundance, that's going to depend on how the dark matter couples to the standard model. So it's going to depend exactly what we have here in this blob, right? It's going to depend on how complicated the dark cycle state is. It also is going to depend on exactly the cosmological history above BBN, which we don't have data on exactly, right? So we don't know. We have a good guess of what the expansion of the universe was like, but we're making assumptions, right? We don't know. We don't have data exactly for that. So there's sort of a few unknowns, but we can make good guesses, or we can make a lot of hypotheses. And theorists have been very good at making a lot of different kinds of models to try and explain what exactly, how you end up with the final abundance that we observe, with the final value abundance. Now, maybe one thing is it's useful to distinguish just maybe terminology, but let me introduce it. Right, so once it's produced, and then you have to get rid of it somehow, and the final abundance is going to depend on the various things that I mentioned, and one of the things it depends on is it depends on when it decouples, when it sort of stops interacting with the standard model bath, and whether the dark matter particle was relativistic at that time or not. So, and what people often do is they distinguish between sort of different kinds of dark matter particles, which are termed cold or warm or hot. And the difference is basically when it decouples. So what we can do is we can define a hot relic, which freezes out or decouples when relativistic. Right, so when this process stopped, if that happens when the particle is still relativistic, then it would be what by definition here I'm calling a hot relic. And then between this, there's two sub-classifications. We can distinguish between hot dark matter then and warm dark matter. And that depends on whether the dark matter decouples, whether the dark matter mass is less than 1 electron volt or more than 1 electron volt. So in this case, the dark matter mass will be less than about 1 eV. And in this case, the dark matter mass will be bigger than about 1 eV. And why is 1 eV interesting? That's when matter radiation equality occurs, okay? And that's also roughly when the CMB was formed, but anyway, that's when matter radiation equality occurs. And structure forms differently before and after matter radiation quantity. So sort of the kind of structure you get in these two different models is different. This is ruled out, okay, so we cannot have hot dark matter. And warm dark matter is ruled out for masses below about a keV, very roughly. Okay, so current limit is that the mass has to be about bigger than a keV. If it were below that, you would not form structure the size of dwarf galaxies, which we observe. Okay, so basically, the dark matter has too much energy still, and very small structure cannot form. It just gets washed out, and if the mass is less than about a keV. And then the other scenario, if it doesn't decouple when relativistic, of course, is just when, if it decouples when non-relativistic, and that is called cold dark matter. Okay, so cold relic or cold dark matter decouples when non-relativistic. And basically the bounds nowadays are such, so remember I told you that I haven't explained why yet, but the bound on the thermal mass window, the lower bound starts about an MeV. So if you really want to have thermal dark matter above an MeV, if you need thermal above an MeV, it's usually called cold dark matter. Okay, so usually it will decouple when non-relativistic. That's sort of the main thing that we'll focus on now. Okay, so cold dark matter candidates. Okay, so now let's do a. So I'm going to do the Fizeau calculation. So I've just show of hands, who's not seen the calculation of Fizeau abundance and sort of the WIMP miracle. Okay, quite a few, okay? And some of you, I'm sure, have seen it and not everyone put up their hand. Okay, good. So, but we're gonna do that. So you need to do this at least once, I think, in your lifetime as a physicist, okay? So let's now discuss, decoupling when non-relativistic. And see what we can learn from that. Right, so we've got an interaction like this that keeps everything in equilibrium. So there's some dark matter particles that are annihilating to standard model fermions and vice versa. And this process is nicely in equilibrium. And these are all the standard model fermion particles. And at high temperatures, we know what the abundance is, right? So at high T, the number abundance of these particles will just be T cubed, okay? But then the temperature drops. It drops below the dark matter mass, and the dark matter energy decreases, the kinetic energy decreases, and becomes non-relativistic. Okay? And in that case, the number abundance doesn't scale as T cubed anymore, but instead it will scale what I wrote on earlier. So let me write that again, right? So this happens at high T, but for T less than dark matter mass, these things become non-relativistic. In that case, the number abundance is going to scale. Yeah, number abundance is going to scale as mass times the temperature, V over 2, E to the minus mass over temperature. Okay. And what you notice from this is that it decreases exponentially. Okay, so here we're learning a very simple way to get rid of the dark matter. Right, so it's actually very simple to get rid of, to remove most of the dark matter particle if it's in equilibrium. If this thing stays in equilibrium for a very long time, it's just going to drop exponentially the number of abundance. So in particular, if it remains in equilibrium forever, the abundance will be completely negligible, right? They would just not have anything left over. But what happens is that as the number of abundance decreases, this interaction rate that describes this process is going to start decreasing as well, because you have less and less, you have fewer and fewer dark matter particles around. They're not going to find each other. They're not going to find a partner to annihilate the standard particles. So this process is going to start shutting off. And when it shuts off, that's what we call freeze out. And that's when the number of abundance of the dark matter particles is essentially fixed. So if chi or if x remains in thermoequilibrium for a long time, it would have negligible abundance. But the process decouples or freezes out. Which fixes the relic abundance. Okay. And when does this happen? When does this freeze out process happen? This happens when the interaction rate becomes less than the expansion rate of the universe. So now we can use the same condition that we had before, gamma, the interaction rate less than the Hubble rate. And we can use that as a condition of when this, to describe this process. So it occurs when gamma becomes, less than h. And we'll use the condition gamma equal to h to estimate at what point this goes out of equilibrium. Okay, so this is my condition. So freeze out when gamma equal to h. So let's now calculate this, right? Estimate it. So it'll take us a bit of time to do this. I'll try and do it relatively quickly, just sort of the main points, but I think it's good to see if you haven't already. Okay, so what's my gamma? So my gamma is again going to be n sigma v, right? N sigma v, and I don't want to always throw around the v. So the v here is the velocity. What we'll find actually is that the velocity is about 0.3 times the speed of light, which makes it non-relativistic. Okay, but it's not small either, right? But we'll see that. So, I don't think I'll specifically show it, but that's you can check that what you get is that satisfies that it's non-relativistic. So we'll actually call this n sigma zero, okay, because I don't want to always write the V. So sigma zero is going to be my sigma V. And V is about 0.3 times the speed of light, okay. Now, sigma V is going to depend on, can depend on velocity in principle, right? So we're going to consider sigma V to just be some constant independent of velocity, but it's possible that you might get sigma V proportional to velocity squared, or even 1 over velocity. So that depends on the specific particle physics model, right? So I think it's good to, let me just write this. So if sigma v goes as v to the 0, we call this S wave. If sigma v goes as v squared, we call this P wave, etc. So we'll just consider this case. And if there's time in the next lecture when I talk about models a little bit, I might come back to this briefly, okay? But for now, I just want to go on with the V to the case, V to zero case. So it depends on specific model of your particle dark matter. Okay, so now what we have to do. We have to solve this equation, gamma equal to H. Gamma is N sigma zero. My H is T squared over M Planck. And we have to solve that. And we're going to solve that expression for the temperature of freeze out. So when the particle freezes out. That's the first thing we're going to do. And then later on, we're going to try and estimate what that means for the dark matter abundance. Okay. First, it's useful to define a variable which is called X. And you can think of this as like a time variable, which is just the mass over temperature. Okay. It's going to simplify some of our expressions, so we'll just do it. And you can think of it as a time variable because as the universe expands, T, temperature decreases, so time increases. So this has a sort of the same direction as time. And we're then going to equate now, so N sigma zero, N is this, mx T 3 over 2 e to the minus m over T. So I'm going to have to write this expression out. So gamma equal to H implies that the mass of the particle, if you do it properly, there's a square root of X. There's a sigma zero. There's an e to the minus X, which comes from m over T being replaced by X. And that's equal to 1 of m prime. And I have to solve this for X. And X, right, so is basically going to give my, is going to be my temperature of freeze out. So I can solve X here. From this expression. And what I get is that this is the log of sigma zero mx m Planck x to the 1/2. Okay, so unfortunately I still have this x to the 1/2 floating around here, right? So I can't directly solve for x. But what I can do is that this is, I can first of all split it up into two terms. Plus log of x over 2, x to the square root of x. And now we have to see if we can just neglect this term. Okay. So now let's go back to sort of a dimensional analysis argument, which works very well, but which allows us to get rid of the second term, which depends on x. So what we're going to observe here is that the cross section, as before, goes as some coupling squared or some power over the mass of the dark matter particle squared. Okay, let's assume that. So if we have the situation where sigma zero goes as, never mind the coupling, I don't care right now, so mx squared. In that case, just from dimensional analysis, right? Then in that case, I can put this in here, and what I see is that I've got a log m Planck over mx. Plus this log of x to the 1/2. Okay. And if you take the mass of the dark matter now, not crazy large, then this is going to be log of a large number. But the log of any large number is a reasonable number. Okay? And this log to the x to the 1/2 is basically not going to contribute to this. I'm going to just ignore this term because it just gives a small correction. And I'm just going to focus on the first term. Okay, so this dimensional analysis argument just tells us this is a log of a big number. And because it's a log, x becomes, if you take mx of order 100 GeV or so, or in that range, take GeV up to 100 GeV, the log of that is going to be, the x for that is going to be of order 10 to 50, which is called order 10. Okay? And if you were to take the log of that again, it's not going to give you much of a correction. So, and what this says is that x is of order 10. And what this means is that the freeze out temperature, right, freeze out temperature will be, if I take my x definitions, freeze out temperature is m over x. So this is going to be m x over order 10. So number of order 10. This tells us that the temperature at which the dark matter decouples is a factor of order 10 or so less than the dark matter mass. So indeed, it makes sense that it's non-relativistic, right? Because the energy is given by the temperature, the kinetic is given by the temperature roughly. So this is going to be nicely non-relativistic. So that's consistent so far with all our assumptions that it freezes out non-relativistically. And this is a good number to keep in mind. Okay. So 100 GeV particles going to freeze out at 10 GeV. Okay, so now we have the freeze-out temperature, which makes us happy. Okay, but now we still have to figure out the final abundance. So we have to get the relative abundance. So now let's go back to this expression, gamma equal to H, right? And let's use that one again. So now use gamma is about H, which means that my number abundance at freeze out, so that's, I'm going to denote it with a little f, at freeze out, times the cross section, sigma zero, is equal to the temperature of freeze out over M Planck. Okay, so I'm just using my expression for Hubble again, but now I'm just putting T equal to Tf, freeze out temperature, and gamma is just N sigma zero, which is this. Okay. So this means that my freeze-out abundance is given by Tf squared over sigma zero M Planck. Now, I don't want to know what my number abundance is in some early time of the universe when it freezes out. I want to know what my number abundance is today. So I have to scale this number to what it would be today. So once it freezes out, the number density, like the number of dark matter particles, is fixed. So in any co-moving volume, if you just consider any volume, which is going to expand then with the expansion of the universe, the number of dark matter particles is fixed. But I want to know what the actual density is. Okay. So we have to estimate that. Let me write this. So after freeze out, after FO freeze out, NX in a co-moving volume is fixed. Which means it only changes because of the expansion, i.e. NX only changes due to expansion of the universe. So what this means is that my number abundance today is going to be given just by the scale factor at freeze out over the scale factor today times nx at freeze out. Okay, so I'm going to just expand the volume space to what it would be from freeze out to today, and my number density is going to scale with that. Now, there's different ways of writing this, but one useful thing is that we're assuming that there's no change in the entropy of the universe, okay, after this freeze out, so that basically, so the entropy is fixed, which has some fancy name, I think, isoentropic universe. What I have is that my entropy density times the volume, essentially, which is scales as A cubed, this is a constant. And what this means is that, well, what I notice is that S goes as 1 over A cubed, and you notice that the number abundance scales as A cubed. So what I can do is I can write N chi of 0 in terms of the entropy density at freeze out over the entropy density, sorry, other way around, entropy density today over the entropy density at freeze out times the number of dark matter particles done by dark matter particle density at freeze out. And these quantities, S0 and SF, today, basically S0 goes as T0 cubed. So we know the answer. So it's about, if you put in all the factors of pi correct, etc., it's about 1,000 per cubic centimeter. So we have just a numerical value sitting here for S0. And for S at freeze out, that depends on the freeze out temperature, which we know because we've calculated it. Right. That's our freeze out temperature. And if you put all this together, what you then get is that the number density of particles of dark matter particles today is going to be given by S0, just this numerical number, over freeze out temperature, σ0, and M Planck. And if you want the contribution to omega, the dark matter abundance in terms of omega, so in terms of the fraction of the critical density, all we have to do is we take omega, so for my X particle, this is going to be given by M dark matter particle Nx today over the critical energy density. And that is putting in all the numbers now. So putting my Nx0, that's going to be S0 freeze out temperature, which is this quantity here. Write it again. That's my freeze out temperature here. So S0 XF over the critical density times σ0 times M Planck. That's the dark matter abundance. And that's the thing we want to have equal 0.26, roughly. Okay. So what do you notice? This thing scales as one of a σ0. Okay. Doesn't a leading order depend on the mass of the dark matter? It's mass dependent, essentially, but it depends on σ0. Of course, if σ0 has mass dependence, then omega is going to have mass dependence, but it would depend on it through the cross-section. The freeze-out temperature is log-dependent on the cross-section. The log is not going to change much. If I change the cross-section by fewer than magnitude, the log is not going to change that much. Okay, it's going to change by an order one number. So this is an important observation, that omega pi goes as 1 by σ0. Does that make sense? Okay, so that makes sense. So let me draw the following diagram, which is a well-known diagram. So if I ask what's the abundance of the dark matter now in a co-moving volume, so let me take this to be n chi over S, okay, the entropy density. Often this is just denoted by Y, but it doesn't matter. This is just some quantity, nx over S, where it's basically co-moving number density, right? And I'm going to plot it as a function of time in terms of the x variable, m over t, essentially as a function of time. And what you find is that at very low x, which means very high temperatures, so the universe is relativistic, the dark matter particles are relativistic, the number of abundance doesn't change much, only very slowly, as the temperature slowly decreases. Then the dark matter becomes non-relativistic, and then it decreases exponentially. And it would just keep decreasing exponentially to have negligible abundance until... unless it freezes out. And the freeze out happens, in which case, once it freezes out, once the dark matter decouples, then this abundance is going to become fixed in the co-moving volume. So this is roughly when freeze out happens. That's my XF. Here, the dark matter is non-relativistic. And up here, it's still relativistic. And exactly when it freezes out, that depends on my σ0, on the cross-section. The larger the interaction strength, the larger the cross-section between the dark and the standard model particles, the longer it's going to remain in thermoequilibrium, the longer it's going to have this exponential suppression, the less of the dark matter there will be. Okay, so this thing is going to, as you know exactly where it freezes out, that's going to depend on what sigma zero is. And if I make sigma zero larger, then I'm going to go lower on this curve. So let me write it as increasing sigma zero. Now, of course, you know, well, so what do we have to do? We have to find the correct sigma zero, essentially. Find the cross section at which I get exactly the right relic abundance that we observe. And we can do that. And if you do that, I have maybe three more minutes, and then we'll stop. So if you put in all the constants, also the ones that I, or if you put in most of them, many of them I neglected, what you get is that omega x is approximately the observed dark matter relic abundance times, let me take a freeze out x of about 25, so that's order 10, right? And the sigma zero I need is about 3.5 to 10 to the minus 9 GeV inverse. There's different ways of writing this cross section. So this is written in natural units there. This would be about 10 to minus 36 centimeters squared, also known as a picobon. And if I put in, remember, sigma zero is actually sigma v. If I put in the velocity parameter as well, the velocity dimensions as well, I get 3 times 10 to minus 26 centimeter cubed per second. And this cross section, I don't know what I wrote here, meant to be PB, picobon. This cross section is a weak interaction cross section. This is what you would get for standard model particles interacting, scattering with the weak force. Okay, so we can ask, what's the WIMP miracle, right? And you can argue it's a miracle, but what you get is that if you take a cross section that is essentially given by the weak gauge couplings, alpha weak squared, over a dark matter mass, so this is about 1 over 50 over mx squared, and if I put in the right, if I put in a certain dark matter mass, I'm going to get exactly this 3.5 to 10 to the minus 9 GeV inverse squared. In this particular example, the way I've written it, it's for 340 GeV over mx. And what you see is that for a particle that interacts with the weak gauge bosons of order as the right interaction of the weak force with a mass of order the weak scale, right? That's where our W and Z bosons lie. That's where the Higgs BEV is, of order 100, 200 GeV, 100 GeV. Then I get the right relic abundance. And I think this is worth writing on this point. So a particle with weak scale, so order 100 GeV masses or mass, and the weak interaction strength given by the weak force as the observed relic abundance. Okay. I should stop. Or should I? Let me make one more point and then I'll stop, sorry. Okay. So this is intriguing, right? Dark matter could be anything. Now, we have other reasons to think that there should be new physics at this weak scale. So chief among them is the Higgs hierarchy problem. Why is the weak scale so much weaker than the Planck scale? And often that requires new particles that people introduce to solve this Higgs hierarchy problem, like supersymmetry. And with this argument, what we're seeing is that those kind of particles, if one of them is stable, they can easily sort of be a dark matter candidate. They're a good dark matter candidate. So this is one of the reasons, I think, why weak interacting massive particles, or WIMPs, have gotten a lot of attention because of the sort of coincidence that you naturally get the 100 GeV scale, where we think there should be new physics. Now, another reason why WIMPs are so popular is because it's easy to look for them. And that I'll talk a little bit more about next time. But let me leave it here. So is this really a miracle? Is it really just specific to the weak scale that we can get this right abundance? And the answer is no. And I'll start that for the next lecture. Thank you.
Question?
I understood that the number density for thermal dark matter doesn't really depend on the production mechanism, but I was wondering whether, I mean, you still have to come up with a production mechanism, right?
When you say production mechanism, like, you mean
isn't it
high temperatures in the universe? So then it just gives
back
T2.
To
the final abundance does depend on exactly how it interacts, right? How it decouples from the standard model. It depends on...
Sure, but which type of cosmological history are we imagining for a WIMP?
So we're assuming radiation domination above BBN, that it reheats to something well above an MeV temperature, well before Big Bang nuclear synthesis, that the universe is radiation dominated, that there's no matter domination or anything like that. But it's just nice to be radiation dominated.
Okay, thanks.
Which is a reasonable assumption. It's an assumption.
I'm sorry, maybe another question. Could we have also non-thermal dark matter in this mass range?
Yes. So I'll talk about dark matter that is has very weak contact with the standard model, so it's not really thermal. Tomorrow I'll mention one candidate. I'll mention Friesen as an example. But in principle, you can have lots of other mechanisms. We can produce it from, you can produce the dark matter from some decay of a heavier particle. That's an example where it wouldn't be thermal. There's examples.
Thank you.
But if it's non-thermal, right, the question is, can you detect it in the laboratory? Because would it have large enough couplings that you can actually detect it? The answer is there are some candidates that you can detect. But it does become harder. But the first things you look for in sort of for weak scale masses are not non-thermal candidates because they've got small couplings. They have to, they're non-thermal, and therefore they'll have small interaction with your laboratory detector.
Cool. Okay.
There's one more there. Behind the pole.
So how much do these numbers shift for? S wave, P wave, and higher velocity dependent cross sections. How much of a just orders of magnitude range can I get around this kind of scale?
So for P wave, it doesn't shift much. And the reason is because the velocity of the freeze out, I didn't prove it, but I mentioned it, it's non relativistic, but it's large. It's about 0.3, right? So even if you've got a sigma V, the V squared suppression, so it's within order magnitude, right? So then you need to change your couplings a little bit to compensate for the velocity suppression. Mm-hmm. But it's not that important for the freeze-out. It becomes important at later times when you might get bounds from a quasi microwave background. And hopefully I'll mention that tomorrow.
Maybe it's hidden somewhere in the calculation, but I'm wondering, since we're only considering S wave here, what's the physics that makes we believe that dark matter should drop up when they're non-relativistic?
What's the physics that makes us believe that dark matter drops up when non-relativistic?
They freeze out when they're non-relativistic.
I mean, it depends on the mass, right? So if the dark matter mass is heavy, then it can annihilate just standard model particles, right? As long as it's above the electron mass. Well, even below the electron mass, even below an MeV, you can annihilate neutrinos and photons. But if you want to... I also made it through the whole lecture.
Right, but in this calculation, there's nothing preventing us from, you know, considering sub-GeV particles.
Oh, no. So sub-GeV is fine. In fact, right now we don't know what the lower limit is, right? MeV is fine. 100 kV is fine. At some point it becomes screwy, but we'll see why tomorrow.
So I guess what I'm asking is, when you draw this curve, you already labeled like dark matter should decouple when they're non-relativistic.
That was the assumption, right? So I made the whole derivation on the assumption that the dark matter is non-relativistic when it decouples. And that was a crucial ingredient because I put my n chi, right, that I assumed, I made it to be the non-relativistic distribution.
Okay.
So yeah. If I make it relativistic, what happens is that the final energy density is proportional to the dark matter mass. And the problem with that is, well, the problem with the dark matter is also hot, and then the structure formation will just get messed up. So we just don't see that. Right, so neutrinos are an example of hot dark matter, if you like. Right, if you imagine neutrinos, we didn't know about them, we're looking for them. They're hot dark matter component essentially, and their mass is constrained to be very small from cosmology, and about less than 0.2 eV, so that their contribution to the energy density of the universe is very small. Forget the number, but 0.004 or something. I might be wrong. I have to look it up. But, so the omega, like omega neutrino, is very, very small. But you know, I don't know, many years ago people thought neutrinos could be a great dark matter candidate that would decouple when they're relativistic, but that's just not seen in data because the structure would form differently. It would form big structure first and then you would sort of break up into smaller structure, and what we see instead is that we see hierarchical structure formation where you build up small ones, you start with the smaller ones and build up to larger structures. So it's just not hot dark matter.
Okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
I'm going to back up, like, way back, because there's two assumptions that you gave us that I'm not quite understanding. The two are that we want to get rid of most of the dark matter, and the other one is that the interaction rate has to be bigger than the expansion rate. Are both of those true because we want dark matter that does interact with the standard model, or is there something else that you were... Like, why are those two things true?
So, the interaction rate being larger than the expansion rate, what I did there was to show you what the coupling needed to be, just back of the envelope estimate.
Why?
We saw that the coupling had to be larger than, what was it, 10 to minus 10 for 100 MeV particle, right? That was just for that, that was just to show you that the coupling needed to be larger than something, right? I was just deriving what, how large did the interaction need to be in order for it to be in thermoequilibrium?
We started with gamma is bigger than H, though.
Right. So that was because if the interaction rate is larger than the expansion rate, then my dark matter particles are interacting many, many times as the universe is expanding. So that's sort of a proxy to know if it's in thermoequilibrium or not.
Why does it? Can you not be in thermal equilibrium without having them interact? Is that why?
The way I'm doing it here, what I'm assuming for both these lectures is that everything is in chemical equilibrium as well. So there's like A plus B goes to C plus D and everything is nice in equilibrium. I'm just like sort of some chemical reaction, right?
Okay.
And in that assumption, I'm assuming that. And in that case, right, the interaction rate will just be... So if you decouple, they could still have distributions that happen to have the same temperature, but they're not obviously in thermal equilibrium anymore.
Okay. And then, so the other one that I mentioned was why we're trying to get rid of the dark matter abundance in the first place.
Yeah, so I just made the point that if you start with a T-cubed abundance, that's huge, right? So especially unless the dark matter mass is very small, T-cubed abundance is a large number of dark matter particles. And actually what you have to do is you have to figure out how to get rid of it. Now, we learned here it's very easy to get rid of it, because if you wait until the dark matter is non-relativistic, its abundance is going to start dropping exponentially. Right, so it's not complicated to have a smaller abundance, but you start out with a huge abundance to begin with. When you get rid of it. I was just trying to make that point.
Thank you.
Okay, let's thank Ruben again. And,